So the more hoops we have, the more drop-off there is. But really, in terms of behavior economics, it's about how much effort we have to go through to do it. And the more effort it takes, the more likely we are going to be to give up. So
the piece of knowledge that you have, the research that you've done, the interviews that you've done, just might fill in the gap for somebody else. And they can have a better life or a better experience at work. Or
how to change your wording. So we call it framing, and how to adapt your wording in a way that comes across softer, because those things influence the type of conversation that you're going to have with that person.
Before we start this podcast, will you please like, follow, and subscribe to the Right Place podcast right here on YouTube, Spotify, or Apple Podcasts. Rudolf and I would also love to connect with you on LinkedIn, so look us up there too. Thank you. Cheers. You're at the right place. My name is John, and today we're going to be diving down into if your team isn't performing, your clients aren't converting, or your goals keep stalling, it might not be a strategy problem. It might be a behavior problem. My guest today is Kevin Joseph. He's a highly qualified behavioral economist. He's on a mission to transform the BPO industry. He's helping businesses boost results by applying behavioral science where it's often ignored: customer conversations, employee mindsets, and frontline performance. He's also the founder of Thrive BPO. He's a builder at heart and a firm believer that better decisions equals better outcomes. Welcome, Kevin. It's great to chat to you today.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here, truly. Thanks, John.
Thanks, Kevin. So today we're going to be unpacking how behavioral insights can supercharge results. We're going to be looking at your own journey, how that's been shaped by different environments and mentors, and what it really means to be in your right place in 2024. So let's dive right in. Kevin, when I studied my BCom many years ago, I did Economics 101 at university, but my textbook didn't talk too much about behaviors or anything like that. Can you give us the gist behind behavioral economics?
Yeah, of course. It's one of the questions I have to answer the most, because whenever I tell people that I'm a behavior economist, they look at me a bit funny, and I get it. It's these two terms that kind of don't really work together. So what happened with behavior economics is economists built models of how to predict what humans are going to do. So in the marketplace, so they built this model of a human being, and the model of the human being that they built is based purely on rationality. According to standard economics, if I go to the shop and I buy a packet of Lay's potato chips, I'm going to continue to do that forever because I've defined my preferences. And there's a whole bunch of other axioms that are within standard economics or traditional economics. Now, what happened is that some psychologists, and in fact, a few economists as well, started to realize that these models that were built by economists were not applicable in a lot of cases, and people were irrational. So psychologists and economists started working together to create a model, not of how people ought to behave or how we'd like them to behave, but how people actually behave. Because the truth is that people are not rational. We are very irrational. We're very emotional creatures. And a lot of that drives our decision-making day to day. So that in a nutshell is what behavior economics is. It's the culmination of psychology, economics, neuroscience, and the social sciences to bring together a more realistic picture of how a human being actually makes decisions and behaves in the marketplace.
And would you say that the general public or the consumer out there is getting less and less predictable? I can imagine 100 years ago, people would pick up their newspaper, they'd drink their cup of coffee, they'd drive to their shop, they'd buy what they always bought, and then come back home. Nowadays, I decide if I want to watch YouTube or TikTok or spend time on Facebook. Then I've got a myriad of options in terms of online retail. I've got Uber Eats. There's so much stuff happening. Is that making it harder and harder to predict how human beings behave?
So it's a great question. And to answer that question, let me start by saying that for a behavioral economist, we tend to believe that there are certain behaviors primarily that are developed through our wirings in the brain over evolution that make people very predictable, and that's systematic. So that part we believe is stable, and that pretty much all human beings have that stable line that we can predict in behavior. One example, maybe it's a bad example, but let's use it anyway, is smiling. So smiling is a common trait in every culture that people show friendliness, whether it's Western cultures or even tribes in the middle of the Amazon. Smiling throughout humanity is considered to be a gesture of friendliness and accommodation. So there's wirings in the brain that we believe are stable, but that's not the only thing that affects decision making. The other things that affect decision making, and you've just mentioned it, context. So the environment in which we make decisions and also our social environment. So human beings, we're social animals, we impact each other's decision making in far more ways than actually we think, and we underestimate that a lot. So are we becoming more unpredictable? I don't think we're becoming more unpredictable. I think that the amount of options on the market and competition has made it more necessary for businesses to gear towards how human beings actually behave. So human behavior, I don't think is less predictable, but I think that the marketplace is so much more unpredictable, and it is a factor in how we make decisions. One thing I can say that has really affected our unpredictability in a way is our attention span. It's so much shorter. So the common thing about I'm going to buy from you today and then I can predict that you're going to buy from me again tomorrow is just not the case anymore, because there are so many options on the market and we can switch very quickly. So I hope that answers it. It's kind of a yes and no in a sense.
No, 100%, Kevin. And now let's focus on the businesses out there. What would you say is like the number one behavior or blind spot that you see holding some businesses back that maybe a behavioral economist like yourself can assist with?
So it depends what we're talking about, actually. If we're talking about businesses in terms of sales, it could be one thing. If we talk about retention, it could be another thing. So in terms of behavior, I'll give you one. And I think this is fundamental, is if you want people to do a behavior, make it simple. Make it as simple as possible to do that. So one thing I think that goes wrong with businesses is they try to make things too complicated. When we make things too complicated, we put what's called channel factors in the way of decision making. So if I wanted to encourage someone to do something, let's say it's sign up to my newsletter, or if I wanted to get them to buy a product in terms of e-commerce, I want to make that process as simple as possible. The moment I make it complicated and we make more hoops for people to jump through, you could call it drop-off. So the more hoops we have, the more drop-off there is. But really, in terms of behavior economics, it's about how much effort we have to go through to do it. And the more effort it takes, the more likely we are going to be to give up. So one thing in business that I would say is really fundamental to getting human beings to behave is make it simple, make it easy, and then people are more likely to do it.
I'm a big fan of that. I mean, the example that immediately springs to mind is the one-click purchase with Amazon, that you don't have to go check cart, do this, click this. Like, I can just click buy one with one button and it takes me checkout, done and dusted. Especially if you don't have to think too much about the purchase, you're not weighing up too many options or anything like that. You know what you want, you put it in your cart, let me just get this over with. And I mean, I've said this to people as well. You need to make it as easy as possible for people to do business with you. If there's any frustration in the process, they might abandon ship and go and find something that's easier. If there's an extra form or an extra click or an extra this or that, they're going to get frustrated because they are used to doing stuff easier with other service providers. They might not even be in your industry or your niche or whatever, but they've become accustomed to, well, this is easy. I can purchase this with a couple of clicks. Now you're expecting me to fill this out, then do this, then wait for you. Then you're going to phone me or you're going to email me. Like, I'm just going to move on. And I think businesses then get frustrated that, but our product is so good, our service is so good. Well, that's not the problem. It's the process that is the problem. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, absolutely. So that's the irrationality, right? Is I might, let's say there's two services. Now, me as the consumer, as the customer, I might get a lot more benefit from the more complicated process. Maybe I'm giving them more information that helps them to tailor it a bit more for me, or whatever it is. Maybe the more steps is actually better for me. Now, this is the irrationality, because in standard economic thoughts, if we were this rational being, we would say, well, I'm doing more steps, but the benefit is worth the effort. The truth is that we're not irrational, we're irrational. So we would rather go for the shorter process, even though it gives us less of a benefit at the end of the day. So yeah, I mean, I totally agree with that. And the answer, a lot of companies, the answer for them is to make the beginning process very short and easy. So you get in and then they start asking you all the questions, which is probably a good hack. It's a good behavioral hack, honestly, because once your foot is in the door and we've invested time as human beings, we also tend to continue with that particular line for much longer if we've invested in it.
Excellent, Kevin. I love that answer and I love that explanation. And now, Kevin, you've told me that there are people that think that this field of work, behavioral economics, is fluffy copywriting. That is such a crazy term. What is your response to that? Because I get it immediately. Like just spending time on your website and talking to you now, I get it, because these small, subtle differences can make a huge impact. Is that kind of where you start explaining it to people?
So, and by the way, if there's any behavioral economist who listens to this, I am almost 100% sure that they will have had this experience where people think that we're fluffy copywriters. The thing with behavioral economics, and this comes actually from a lot of the work that was given to behavioral economists in the corporate space. So I did a lot of work in the corporate space. And what you end up doing is a lot of what we call tactical work rather than strategic work. So tactical work involves, let me write an SMS and put some behavioral nudges in there to nudge behavior. Let me write a call center script, WhatsApp messages in a digital journey. And the behavior economist ends up being a cog in the process that is just, well, somebody wrote a message. I give it to the behavior economist to fluffy it up, to make it sound nice so that we use personalization, which is now a very old term. We put your first name in the message, right? There's a behavioral reason for that. It catches attention and you're more likely to engage because your name's in it and it's very personal. So this is how that came about, is we got a lot of communications, touch points to rework and add behavioral nudges in so that they became more persuasive and more engaging. And slowly but surely, the more work that you do of that, people just start to hand off stuff to you that becomes copywriting. The problem is that what we use is science-backed. It's all research-based. And it's based on lots and lots of research on how human beings actually behave and how the brain works. So it becomes more difficult to then explain to people who think you're a fluffy copywriter that what I'm putting in here is based on thousands of hours of research and experimentation. So that's what I would say. And that becomes the complicated part, is just where behavior economists have typically been positioned in the value chain, in terms of like corporate and that sort of thing. And then really trying to show them that what we're doing is science backed. And we often do that. So we'll include notes and to try and show them the studies, and we try and experiment too.
And I think the backing of science and research, and that you've got hard examples to prove what works and what doesn't work anymore, or at least put forward the current trends in terms of communication, I think is really good. And now, Kevin, in 2025, leaders have a lot to keep track of, not just the finances or the strategy or the execution of the business, but some of these, I would say, more new age concepts that have come along over the last couple of years. Things like safe spaces, psychological safety, empathy, introverts, hybrid working, and of course, AI. Where do you think behavioral economics or some of those concepts can help leaders execute their roles better?
Yeah. So I'll try and chat about the different, like how they fit in, because behavior economics would fit into all of those buckets. But let's take, for example, conflict management. So in terms of leadership, you're not always going to, and conflict management is something that I've done for my clients, putting together the entire process and then training the team leaders and also the employees on how to approach conflict in a better way in order to get a better result at the end of the day, because Conflict can either be good conflict or bad conflict. Conflict that's good conflict focuses on the future and the situation and the problem at hand. Bad conflict tends to focus on personal attributes. You're like this, and therefore whatever you're doing is wrong, or you're not going to fit in, and your voice doesn't mean anything. So conflict management fits in with psychological safety. So that's the first one. Psychological safety, a big one that we understand in behavior, is when people lose trust in their leaders because they believe that their leaders aren't being transparent with them, then we start to destroy psychological safety. And I've been able to measure that. So when I go into a company, and that is something that I measure, is trust and transparency. Because when I correlate trust and transparency with things like team dynamics, you find that an increase in trust and transparency increases team dynamics, because people are more free to give ideas. And mainly it is the understanding that they believe that their ideas will be heard. If we don't believe our ideas are going to be heard, we actually just stop giving them. So training leaders on that has been extremely helpful, particularly when I can show the change, when I can correlate team dynamics and trust and transparency. I think people start to get it a bit more when they see a tangible outcome of behavior and how these two things can really increase. Yeah. Then in terms of AI, behavior economics has become really relevant throughout these new technological changes that we're going through. When it came to robotics, so RPA, there was a big need for behavior economists, because the people that were writing the code for algorithms are human beings. And so you can't take the human being out of the code. The biases that we have went into the code as well. So there was a big need for behavior economists to start getting involved in like robotic process automation, so that we could help the devs create algorithms that were slightly less biased. If you think about it in terms of recruitment, you could get a RPA, a robotic process automation, to read a CV, and that CV might still pick out people based on racial bias, right? It's just the way that we've written the code. In AI, I foresee us having the same issue, and that's where behavior economics will fit in, is how do we tailor the AI to work for humans as humans are, and not how we hope that they should be.
No, I love that answer, Kevin. And it just goes to show you that the sciences have so much value to add, not just in your own niche, but in different lanes, in different spheres, in different pockets of the world. And also that leaders shouldn't disregard this stuff. Just because you don't understand it yet doesn't mean you should say, that's nonsense, or it's fluffy copywriting, let's just leave it. But there's a lot of nuance here, and there's a lot of, I think, finer details and small things that can add up to a big value in the end. And you founded Thrive BPO to democratize access to behavioral science. Can you just tell me the thinking behind that, and what sparked that vision?
Yeah, absolutely. So I worked in corporate for a very long time, and unbeknownst to a lot of people, the big corporates have teams of behavior economists, people just like me, that are creating these communications and working in every area of business. I mean, I've worked in every era, literally from sales all the way through to exits. I've done it all. Now, what I found is, first of all, the call center environment, I've done a lot of work there, and I love the call center environment. I enjoy working with call centers. It's very dynamic, but also call centers have a lot of pain points, and they are tough industries. The employees, if you take the floor of a call center, it's very loud, it's very distracting, it's very monotonous. You tend to do the same type of work over and over and over again. You are very money-based, which individualizes people, and it is very repetitive. So they're tough. And also, people are pretty mean. Like, we all get calls now all the time. So the psychological impact on a call center agent is actually quite intense. And then, of course, we expect them to be happy on the call, right? Like, we just expect them to be happy. Meanwhile, a lot of call center agents in South Africa have come from very tough backgrounds, very tough areas where there's gangsterism, and they experience that every day, daily. And then they get to work, and we expect them to be happy. So these are really tough areas to be in. So that was the one thing. The next thing is these teams that are in corporates, they're very expensive. They cost a lot for this expertise. And it makes the little BPO, I mean, there's huge BPOs, but they've in a sense monopolized it because the consulting groups that leverage that or the internal teams don't work with any of the other BPOs in the industry. So I really wanted to bring behavior economics to the other BPOs in the industry because I had a skill set that I really thought would give them value. And the second thing is the BPO industry in South Africa is blowing up. It's huge. We are really inviting to overseas companies who want to outsource their business to South Africa and to South African BPOs. So I really wanted to be a part of that as well.
And I love the positivity there that you know you can make a difference, you can save businesses money, and you can bring in some of your expertise as well. And now when you're working with these call center teams, you're getting into a lot of detail. Tell me about the impact of embedding empathy into call center scripts.
Empathy is one of the biggest factors in communication generally. It's really big for a call center agent, and it depends on what sort of campaign that call center agent is doing. But just think about this. We have call center agents who call people about life insurance and a death in the family. So a death claim. Let's take an insurance claim, right? So an insurance claim. You've got a death claim or a disability claim, severe illness claim. All of these things are agents having to call and then find out these details from their clients about what's happened. The customer on the other end of the line, the person on the other end of the line is maybe experienced trauma. They are in mourning because a parent, a friend, a brother, sister, whatever has died. And it is that agent's, it's on the agent to connect with that person in a way that makes them feel comfortable to really engage with you. So empathy becomes incredibly important. Now, not just that, take debt collectors as an example. Same thing with the unemployment rate in South Africa. A lot of people, you call them, they've bought something and they get called by a call center and now they've just lost their job. And now you have to convince that person listen to you and set up an arrangement with you so that you can, you know, start to pay off your debt or whatever it may be. So empathy becomes incredibly important. Now, for behavior economics, we understand tone is really important in terms of empathy. How to change your wording. So we call it framing, and how to adapt your wording in a way that comes across softer, because those things influence the type of conversation that you're going to have with that person and how likely they are to listen to your message. A lot of it has to do with that. How persuasive. So there's a famous book by a behavior economist and maybe the most practical behavior economist of our time called Robert Cialdini, called Influence was his first book and Persuasion is his second book. And what he shows us is that the way you set up a conversation beforehand often defines the conversation that follows. And empathy has a lot to do with that. How we approach people changes the conversation that we have from that point onwards. So empathy is a big one that I include in any and all work that I do with BPOs, because it's about being influential and it's about being convincing, not manipulative. It's about creating a message that people are more likely to listen to. Because if people don't listen to you, they're not going to act if they don't want to, then they're just not going to. So you have to become persuasive. And that's what empathy is about.
And I love the care and also the thought that's put into this. And this doesn't just come from call center scripts as well. I mean, you're also looking at other forms of communication, emails and templates and that. Tell me about that as well.
So I'll give you a fun example. It's empathy, but it's perceived empathy, and it's based on a social norm more than anything else. So I don't know if you do this, John, but when you write an email to someone, do you put, I hope you're well at the beginning, right? So I hope you're well.
Sometimes.
So you say, hi, Kevin, I hope you're well. Now, this actually used to drive me crazy. It used to drive me crazy because I don't think most people care. Like if it's a close friend, if it's someone that you really care, I hope you're well. But a lot of the time we're just pushing emails around and we say, I hope you're well. Now, there's empathy in that because oftentimes, you know, we do hope people are well, but we don't really have an emotional connection at all to that person. But here's the thing. So it is empathy. It is. It's, I hope you're well. I hope you're doing good. Adding more details to that, by the way, makes it even more effective. So I hope you're well. I heard the weather's really cold in Cape Town, so I hope you're staying warm. Okay, so you add a bit more personal detail to it, and that boosts the idea of empathy. When we write emails and communications to people, yeah, we put that stuff in because it reflects an empathy. Now, whether you mean it or not, it changes behavior because now it is, I come across as starting off with a caring or with a empathetic message. When we don't have that, we lose that the emotional impact that we get from it. Now, over time, maybe it loses its effect, but we also expect people to ask that question. And this is why I took it out because it used to drive me crazy. So I stopped doing it, but then I started doing it again because it's become a social norm to ask the question and to say, I hope you're well, and to, you know, and to do that. The step further is to actually really care and to not just say, I hope you're well, but to say, it's cold in Cape Town. Like, I heard there's floods going on and I'm up in Joburg at the moment. It's freezing cold. To add that extra layer of empathy, that boosts the message and the emotional reaction to that, just that simple line by a huge amount. And that person, after reading that, is your persuasiveness is, or your persuasiveness to the rest of the message is probably going to be boosted by a huge amount. But you've definitely connected with that person on another level. So we put that into emailers. I mean, I would recommend that people do that generally, is just go that extra mile and add that little bit more care so that you're not just stuck in the social norm, which used to drive me crazy, which was, I'm saying this, but I don't really care. Now I say it, but I also try and add a bit more of the real empathy and not just what they expect me to say at the beginning of a message because I want something.
I think that's a great tip there because you can also personalize it. So you can start with, I hope you're well, and then mention something that's relatable, like the weather in Cape Town, or you know something about their family, or you know what project they're busy doing. That just cements the rest of the conversation in a more personal format, where if you just get on with it, I need help with this, or can you do this for me? I think the person loses that warmth and then they might not necessarily want to respond on that email immediately. They'll be like, flip, John is just asking for something again. I'll deal with this nonsense later. Whereas if you just spent that two extra seconds, you might activate a much faster response.
Totally. Totally. I totally agree with that. And it will happen. Like you said, you'll deprioritize the person that is being less empathetic to you. It's just who we are as human beings. A cornerstone of humanity and of human society is reciprocity. I give, you feel an obligation to give back. So it's also a form of reciprocity. I give empathy. And this is built into our brains, by the way. There is an obligation to give back. I don't know if you've noticed, if someone lets you into traffic, you're more likely to let someone else into traffic later on down the line. Reciprocity is not just you give something and I give something to you. It's like pay it forward sometimes.
Yeah, 100%. Now, Kevin, you're currently building a service to help people navigate an increasingly overwhelming world. Tell me about that service and what excites you about this challenge.
Oh, man. Yeah, it is exciting for me. So I'm a new business owner. And at the end of last year, I went through a lot of change. There was a lot of turbulence, just generally. I found myself wanting to sit down and plan for my business. I wanted to do a bit of sense check with myself and, you know, understand what my values were, what my beliefs were. Really solidify what those things are because those help with decision-making. Where are my finances at? Where's my social circle at? Where, you know, we have all these Venn diagrams that cross in our life. And I don't think you can separate those things. We all want to, we all, you know, we have these goals and we really can't separate those parts of our life. So I felt incredibly overwhelmed. Not just that, because there's so much information on the internet right now. If you go on the internet right now, there are 50 different people telling you why veganism is great, vegetarian, why you should do a carnivore diet, why vegetable-based, I don't know. There's like 100 different things. And that's the same for every part of life. How you should react with your friends, what you should do in business. It's very overwhelming. Not just that, but life has become busier than ever. I can only imagine how full your inbox gets with emails and all the meetings that you have to do. So the world is incredibly distracting. How do we take away some of that distraction, help people to focus on their goals that they really want to achieve and help them to plan a way forward? So I set out to understand this a bit more. And I started out by doing, I set a goal for doing 50 interviews with people to ask them about what their challenges are, what their barriers are to reaching the goals, what they wish for, what they, how they feel when they don't, when they set a goal and they don't achieve it. I wanted to understand all those things. So I set that all up because I, with this project, with this initiative that I'm building, I really want to help people to try and cut through the noise, understand who they are, what they want to achieve, and then put strategies in place to help them get there using my knowledge of the of behavior economics and human behavior and decision making. So I don't yet know how it's going to turn out, but I have the data. I'm busy analyzing it now, and it's very insightful, honestly, some of the things that I've learned. And yeah, it really excites me to be able to. So one of my values is to help people using my skill and knowledge. I feel very strongly about that. So this is one of those avenues that I think could make a real difference in people's lives, just to help them really focus in on what they need to do, focus in on what's important. And put all the other stuff to the side because we are bombarded with so much information. It causes what we call cognitive overload or information overload. And behaviorally, what happens when we're in that state is we actually do nothing. We procrastinate when we become overloaded. So I really want to help people turn planning, their own unique plan that works for them, into action and actually execute on those things. Yeah.
And I think that helping aspect that you're bringing here is so important. And I'm a firm believer in, if you have expertise in something, if you have wisdom, knowledge, years of experience in something, you should be helping other people with that. You should be putting it out there either on LinkedIn or on podcasts or in some sort of research and just helping people get out of their own way, because not everybody knows everything. And it's impossible to know everything about everything in this day and age. But the piece of knowledge that you have, the research that you've done, the interviews that you've done, just might fill in the gap for somebody else. And they can have a better life or a better experience at work or a better relationship with someone in their business. So no, I applaud you for that. That's really, really cool. And talking about helping people find their right place, at the Right Place podcast, we believe your right place is at the intersection of your roles, relationships, and environments. And that's what I want to focus on just for the last few moments of our podcast. And you told me that your current favorite role that you're in is chief behavioral economist. Tell me about that and what excites you about that.
Yeah, so I'm very passionate about human behavior. I really do love what I do. And so Thrive BPO is my company, but I don't put myself as a founder or a CEO of that, because what I am is an applied behavioral economist. That's what I am. And I have the experience So chief behavior economist really excites me because it's kind of been my dream role to get to this level where I could say that I've had the experience and I've done experiments and I've looked at human behavior to the point where I can be seen, I guess, as an expert. And I have a long way to go. There are people far more experienced than I am, but what I can definitely bring as living into that title, you know, sometimes that you have to put yourself there and let it be a self-fulfilling prophecy. So make myself a chief behavioral economist and then really grow into that. And I really love that idea. And it speaks to my identity. And identity is a huge part of the things that we go after in life. If we identify as that thing, we tend to work towards it. If you're trying to quit smoking, you should probably identify as a non-smoker. When you incorporate that into your identity, you are far more likely for your behavior to follow suit. So I love being a chief behavioral economist because I love behavior and I love teaching people about what I do and shifting behavior in positive ways. So yeah, that really excites me about being a chief behavior economist. And I'll try and hold on to that title for as long as I possibly can, I think. Yeah.
Awesome, Kevin. Awesome. I love that answer. And Kevin, who are the key relationships helping shape your thinking in 2025? What people are attracting you and those that you are deliberately surrounding yourself with?
So, as I mentioned, I would still call myself a very recent business owner and entrepreneur. And I love spending time with entrepreneurs. I love entrepreneurs generally. They are dynamic, positive, resilient, tenacious executors and go-getters. And those are the people that I'm trying to spend a lot of time with because I have learned in my journey, shifting out from corporate into entrepreneurship, the biggest leaps that I've had in mind shift and in mind shift has been when I've met with entrepreneurs, seasoned, experienced entrepreneurs, just anyone better than me, and have just been able to hear their thoughts and listen to their story and their experiences. Honestly, it's leapfrogged. And I've had a few brilliant entrepreneurs who have given me the time of day, even though I didn't understand why this young little ginger fish in a pond, but they've given me their time of day and have given me real help and insight. And that really leapfrogged my mindset in terms of business and in terms of how to think about it and how to just navigate the chaos that is entrepreneurship, particularly the beginning. So I try and surround myself as much as possible with entrepreneurs. Of course, I also love to chat to fellow behavioral experts because I love to hear their opinion and their perspectives on things. But for right now, entrepreneurs are big time, where my intersection, as you say, really fits.
That's a fantastic answer. And Kevin, you told me that your word for 2025 is just keep going. A powerful phrase, a positive phrase, a phrase full of momentum. Pretty much halfway through the year so far, how has that served you and how's the rest of the year looking?
Yeah, so just keep going. Just keep going. I don't know if you've ever seen this picture, John. It's like it's like a squarely line like this, and it's like your life is never linear, or your journey is never linear. It's full of these ups and downs and all over the place.
Yes.
And I very practically, so if there's anyone, I mean, we're all using ChatGPT these days, but I like to keep quite a lot of my conversations on a particular GPT of mine. And I actually tested this out. So I told ChatGPT to give me a line graph of moments throughout my year. Like, give me a line graph of moments, of good and bad moments, positives and negatives. And what it spat out was literally like this. It was a really practical answer to show you that really it is like this. And there's been many times over the past year that I have been in what's called the trough of despair. Sometimes things aren't working out. You're not going where you think you should be. There's a lot of self-doubt. And in those moments, just keep going. Just keep going. Just keep going is something that I remind myself, because the advice that I've got from these entrepreneurs is, number one, it takes longer than you think. It's never like a short-term answer, and I've experienced that in real life, truly. And if you just persist, because there's a lot of learning that you have to do, if you persist and you just keep going, then you are actually getting closer to your goal, even when you're in that trough of despair and you feel terrible. So that's why I just keep going and just being persistent and resilient are things that I think you grow the more that you just keep going. And yeah, that's why I just keep going. It's been really special. Been really special for me as just a catchphrase in my own head when times are tough and you're doing long hours. Yeah.
And now, Kevin, we always end off our podcast with one last question, and we've been talking about it already. Kevin, what does your right place feel like in 2025?
Sure. My right place. My right place. Well, let me say that my right place. My right place, I believe, is among inspiring entrepreneurs who are making the world a better place, who want to create a world that they see in their own vision is a better place, because that's the world I want to live in. Actually, I watched one of your most recent podcasts yesterday where you spoke about helping people, your colleagues or fellow entrepreneurs, out when they are in the trough of despair. And that's the world I want to live in. I want to live in that world where we can help each other when we're having a tough time, and help each other get out of that trough of despair. So I really believe that my place is my right place is going to be amongst is right there in a place where there are people that I surround myself with that are supportive, encouraging, help you with insight, give without expecting anything in return, and making the and really gearing towards making the world a better place. So I think if I can find that area and engage with those people, yeah, I think that would be my right place.
Awesome, Kevin. I love that answer. And I think that is also being intentional. You're not just leaving it up to chance. You're aware of what works for you, what doesn't work for you, and the people that you need around you to bring out the best in you, to bring out more thriving in the behavioral economic space. So, no, well done for that. That's really, really excellent. Kevin, I've really enjoyed talking to you today. I've learned so much. I think this is a fascinating area to dive into and to do all this research in. So I just wish you all the best with your project, and long may it continue, and long may you keep adding value to your customers and those around you. If people want to connect with you and learn more about Thrive BPO, where's the best place to do that?
So you can definitely email me at kevin@thrivebpo.com. I do have a website, thrivebpo.co.za, or I also would encourage people to go and check out my LinkedIn profile, where of course all my, you know, everything I've done is on there. I post quite regularly in the realm of behavioral science, goal achievement, human flourishing, and BPO. So definitely go and check that out and pop me a message. I'd love to chat.
Awesome, Kevin. Love that, man. Thanks so much. Ladies and gentlemen, this has been Kevin Joseph from Thrive BPO. Please connect with him. Please reach out to him. Connect with him on LinkedIn. Check out his resources on his website as well. Remember to like and subscribe to The Right Place podcast, wherever you may be watching or listening to this. Thank you, Kevin. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. And we will see you next time at The Right Place. Cheers.
Thanks, John.